call the answer line, where you're the head honcho, the big cheese, top dog, big man, mighty boss. And you can tell us exactly where to go.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online. Just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives. The Carillon in the tower above the town hall of Zierikzee, a picturesque fishing village in the province of Zeeland in the southwestern part of the Netherlands. It's a crisp day in February 1993, cold but quite dry. It's taken me just over an hour to get here by car from the giant port of Rotterdam. The centre of town boasts quaint, narrow, cobbled streets which bustle with tourists during the summer months. But in the winter, the locals sit gossiping in the coffee shops, scrutinise the first daffodils in the metal bucket outside the flower shop, picking the best. Outside the library, a slightly torn poster about an exhibition ruffles in the breeze, held in place by three rusty drawing pins. From time to time, a few passers-by stop to examine the poster. One of them, a man of about 55, reads the first few lines and then, obviously reminded of something, successfully dodges the bicycles as he crosses the road and into the bookshop. He emerges a few minutes later with a book under his arm. It's one of several publications issued exactly 40 years after the worst flood the Netherlands experienced since the 16th century. By digging through Radio Netherlands' sound archives, a fascinating portrait emerges of the days immediately following February the 1st, 1953. And it's a story that's relevant to a lot of people today. More than half of the world's population lives within 60 kilometres of the coast. Dutch engineers are applying what they've learned here to flood defence projects in Bangladesh, Indonesia and Egypt. If scientists are right about global warming and the gradual rise in sea level, major port cities like Tokyo, Buenos Aires, Jakarta, New Orleans and Shanghai will have to build costly flood defences early in the next century. Because if you ever take the sea for granted, someday it will strike back.
Revenge of the Tide, a portrait of the Great Flood in February 1953, compiled and presented by Jonathan Marks.
In 1946, the Dutch Ministry of Public Water Works warned that the dikes in several parts of the country weren't high enough. But maintenance of these defences against the North Sea was the responsibility of local committees, run mainly by the farmers whose land was being protected. In the late 1940s, though, people had other things on their agendas. Reconstruction of the country and boosting exports were the main priorities. There was little money put aside to raise and maintain the dikes. Saturday, January the 31st, 1953. A stormy day across this part of northwest Europe. In the course of the afternoon, the wind changed direction from west to northwest. As light began to fade, the Royal Dutch Meteorological Institute sent out an urgent telegram warning of an approaching northwesterly storm and a very high tide. But in the regions which were later affected, the message didn't get through. Anna Frey van der Zander Vleugelschutter lives in Nieuwekerk, a town on the island of Davelland, right in the heart of the Delta area. That Saturday night, her father got a call.
My father, who was a doctor here, he was warned by people from Capelle. And they asked him to come because his baby has to be born there, and the doctor from Zierikzee couldn't come. So he went there, and afterwards he went to Zierikzee, and he saw that Zierikzee, we called it the Gouwe Veerse Polder, was already full of water.
Most people were indoors, many visiting friends. The weather forecast on the radio was grave. Some church bells were ringing out a warning, but the wind was too strong to hear them outside the villages.
But nobody could believe it, because everybody thought, oh, it's just fake, something like that. And when the water will come, it will not be higher as it was in the war.
In spring 1944, areas of this part of Holland were deliberately flooded by the Germans who occupied the territory. They feared an Allied invasion, so the pumps were switched off, flooding many areas to roughly a metre deep. The sea defences were damaged during the construction of bunkers. In the early hours of February the 1st, 1953, years of neglect started a dramatic chain of events. The water pounded against the dikes. The weaker sections were full of holes, so that under the extra pressure, they collapsed. The water pushed through. In total, more than 600 kilometres of sea defences were smashed away.
So it came from everywhere, and it came like a wall of water. You're looking outside, you said, what's that? What's that? And then it was there. A high wall with foam on it, and already a lot of wreckage. Of course, dead trees and from buildings. It came to the houses, and it destroyed the houses.
At first, the strong, bitterly cold wind and driving sleet was too much for the emergency services. The surprise was complete, and there was no real emergency plan. In the early light of Sunday morning, many people in Zeeland were trapped upstairs, with flood water reaching the ground floor ceiling. But the level began to drop a bit, and with a low tide came a false sense of security.
And then they thought, oh, we have had it, it is terrible, it has been terrible. But then another flood came all over the first one. So it was much higher as before. And that was the time when a lot of people were drowned.
As the second flood came on the Sunday afternoon, and the wind and sleet continued, so many houses collapsed. People clung to bits of wreckage in the hope of a miracle. Nieuwekerk was one of the town's worst hit.
It was particularly badly hit because there was a hole in the dike in Ouwerkerk, and there was a hole in the dike in Stevensluis, the south part of the Grevelingen. The currents mixed together, and that makes that so many houses were destroyed.
So how many people lost their lives?
More than 300 here in Nieuwekerk and Ouwerkerk.
Today you can drive over the islands in Zeeland. 40 years ago, you reached many of them by boat. There were hardly any cars. Communications was rudimentary.
There were just a few people who had a telephone. And after 9 o'clock, most of the telephones were closed. You see, just the doctor has a telephone, and I think the fire brigade, but nobody else. So you couldn't make any communication by telephone.
Locals came to the rescue.
The first who came were the fishermen from Zierikzee and Ierseke. They helped us, and I think they came 2 days before the regular help came.
It wasn't until Monday, February the 2nd, that the rest of the world found out the extent of the disaster.
This is Walt Richter speaking from a KLM Dakota DC-3 above the flooded disaster area. We left Schiphol Airport about a half an hour ago and have been steadily flying south. And as we slowly approached the disaster area, we began seeing signs of the flood waters which have encroached upon so much of this land which has been won through so much hard toil from the sea during the past centuries. This disaster rate, I think, is the greatest in Holland's history for the past 300 years. The spirit of the Dutchman here, I think, can be best demonstrated by a group of farmers I saw who were rather ruefully surveying their land from a high point along a dike, who, as we passed over, waved at us to say, well, we did it before and we'll do it again. Another point that showed the flood here is the fact that we're 40 miles inland and still we see seagulls cruising over the wave.
Plane was flying over and everybody thought, oh, they will see us, and now they know how terrible it is here and now the help will come. But it didn't. So that was a very big disappointment.
For the last 20 minutes we've been crisscrossing over Zeeland, the artificial islands in the south of Holland. And if I thought the devastation was complete when I reported to you last, here the difference is approximately that between black and white. At the present time, this ebb tide, so that the waters are draining off the polders. You can see the breaks in the dikes by white water as the water is rushing out. And where the land has become partially dried, one can see great gashes where the water has dragged away the precious topsoil which has been accumulated and improved over the past centuries. Indeed, it's hard to visualize what is going on among these suffering people down below.
An outside broadcast van from Radio Netherlands had arrived at the edge of the disaster area, having reached it via a detour over the Belgian border. Customs officers agreed to ignore the fact that no one had passports with them.
This is Robin Simpson speaking from the island of Walcheren, here in this corner of Holland, close to the Belgian border. I'm sadly reminded of a visit I made last summer, when the fields were green, cattle grazed peacefully, and a ripening harvest promised so well for the industry of the Dutch. An industry which has made Holland the first nation in war-torn Europe to recover anything like a pre-war status. I hardly need to remind you that our currency has been hardened to a degree where martial aid became a thing of the past, a grateful memory. Now, aid is being rushed from Great Britain, from a country whose folk and people had suffered from the fury of the same storm. America and Belgium have come to our aid as well. The task is by no means a light one. After the strategic bombing of the dikes in Walcheren by the Allies at the end of the last war, it took 4 years to eradicate the salt from the soil and make it once more fertile. It's a task which has to be faced all over again. I have, during the night, toured these islands in the southwest of Holland and seen, with the aid of searchlights, much of the devastation. Inhabitants in outlying farmhouses have been rescued from their rooftops or nearby trees. The storm has abated, but the cold persists. Driving sleet has not helped the stricken.
Up to the time that our plane took off, the floods here in Holland had claimed almost 300 lives. And of course, those figures are still incomplete, in which 25% of the land does lie under sea level, and I understand almost 75% of the land has been reclaimed from marshes and from the sea. Nature seems to be playing rather a grim joke today, because we've gone for weeks here now without seeing the sun, and immediately following this great catastrophe, the clouds have lifted and the sun shines down on this bleak landscape, as though to say, well, I've done my worst, now you boys can go back to work. I'll help you a little bit by giving you some light. As I've been talking to you, I've been looking out of the window of the plane over the wing, and just down below now we're coming over a vast flooded area with whole villages underwater. We just see the rooftops. Of course, I'm repeating myself, but I hope I've given you some idea of the magnitude of this great natural disaster here in the Netherlands.
The first priority was to make emergency repairs to the dikes. The next spring tide was expected on February the 16th. Robin Simpson reported from the town of Middelburg, where students were helping out.
Well, listeners, I'm just going down the line now. The wind is whistling round my ears. It's frightfully cold. It's about... I don't know what the temperature is now, but it feels about 20 below, but I'm sure it isn't quite as low as that, but... It's now just coming up for 5:30 in the morning, and I'm going towards a party of men who are working with a huge pile of sandbags, and they're trying to bridge a gap in a dike. I'm going now to see if I can have a word with the leader of the party. I think... Yes, here, this is the leader of the party. He's dressed as a first lieutenant. Oh, yes, in this dim light, I think it's Mr. Hoofdstraten,
yeah,
the gentleman...
Right, that's right.
Well, how are things going with you, Mr. Hoofdstraten?
Well, it's pretty bad, because the dike was broken where we were working, but we are putting all our force in. Perhaps the listeners in Canada may be interesting to hear something from a Canadian student who is studying at Amsterdam Mathematics, Mr. Gilmore.
Oh, Mr. Gilmore, what is your impression so far of this wonderful work you're putting in here?
It's a bit hopeless. We, at times, our sandbags, as we put them in, are swept away, but it's a problem of just keep on going through. Certainly it is much better with the wind down and the tide not so high.
The tide is down now, and you feel that you are actually gaining ground, do you?
Oh, certainly.
So, from Middelburg, in the island of Walcheren in the south of Holland, I return you now to the studio and hope to bring you better news shortly.
Help from abroad started arriving late on Monday. Brian Matthews spoke to Lieutenant Commander Sperring, in charge of the British Royal Naval Helicopter Training Squadron. Their 8 helicopters were stationed in the Brabant area, to the east of Zeeland.
Apart from one Dutch helicopter, we were the first helicopters to arrive here. Our first job was to take radio sets and radio operators out to isolated places so that they could get some sort of contact with the mainland. I then suggested that we took Dutch officers with us who spoke English. We either lured them by winch into places, and they organized landing grounds by cutting down trees and telephone posts and that sort of thing. Owing to the number of places that one landed at, it was often very difficult to remember where you'd left the chap. And we did have one. We left him in an isolated village all night. He organized the whole village completely, did a magnificent job of work, and he told me a rather interesting story. 2 soldiers were rowing round in a boat, and they were going past a house which was almost underwater, and as they went past the bedroom window, they saw a 9-month-old baby in the cot, and they took him out.
How many people altogether have you taken out, either by winch or by landing and pulling them up?
Just over 700 people out. About 70 of these were taken off by winch from housetops and banks and that sort of thing.
How many is it possible to take out at a time in a helicopter?
Officially, we carry a pilot and 2 passengers, but we've had 5, 6, and at one period I had 7 in my aircraft, which is purely by accident.
How do you mean it was by accident?
Well, I looked at them, and they weren't terribly big, so I said, put 5 in. And then when I got airborne, I thought the aeroplane felt rather heavy. When I landed at the other end, I counted them getting out, and there were 7.
In the town of Steenbergen, Lieutenant Colonel Lynn was organising the dispatch of special amphibious vehicles, or ducks.
Well, we are evacuating personnel, animals, both live and dead, vehicles. Even had a mission to evacuate 2,000 dozen eggs that would have spoiled if they had not been evacuated by yesterday.
Well, we're now on the back of one of these amphibious vehicles, which they call a duck. It belongs to the American Army, and right now we are making our way through the water in the flooded areas here in southern Holland. I'll tell you a bit now about the operations of these ducks. They are all centered in a town called Steenbergen, which is right on the edge of the flood area. We were in the operations room before we came out tonight, and it's very amazing. It's almost like warfare, the way these ducks are being run. There are 2 ducks in our group now, and each with a crew of 3 German soldiers and with a German lieutenant in charge. I think if I hold the mic over the edge here, you can probably hear the water swirling past. These ducks are mighty vehicles, plowing our way through here, and now we're coming to another little town, or what remains of it. A road sign passes by, completely submerged, with only the top line showing over the water. We've seen the same sights in every town we've visited in these last few hours, and up on the dry land, where the evacuees are coming in, there are hundreds of, and thousands of them waiting for help and trying to get help in the way of food and clothing and possibly financial aid from the different centers. We visited some of these centers, and I was absolutely appalled by the number of children and wives and men that were wearing the black patch of mourning on their sleeves. You can probably hear the motor of the duck in the background, capable of traveling both on the land and in the water. Right now we are still running on the land motors because the water isn't quite that deep, but if it does get deep, it can just launch itself, and it has a separate propeller for use in the water.
This is Brian Matthew, covered from head to foot in mud and frozen to the bone, reporting to you from Verkendam in the area of Bisbos, which has probably been hit harder than any other. I'm standing at the moment actually in the bottom of a tremendous gap in one of the dikes. This morning we drove our truck, or rather we crawled along the slithery surface of the top of the dike, and suddenly we had to stop and couldn't go any further. Stretching out in front of us was a vast expanse of mud and snow and floating debris. On either side of us are the tremendous stretches of water just lapping against the sides of this flat stretch of land on which we're standing. We tried to get some idea of the difficulties against filling this gap, and we slithered along through the ankle-deep mud to a point where a group of men were matting together great areas of reeds and strong sticks. These are tied in a form of mattress and then taken over the water by barge to the gap where there is no land at all. They're then sunk into the water and weighted down by heavy stones until they rise above the surface of the water. Then on top of that is piled a great heap of earth, and when that has reached sufficient height, the sides are packed with clay and straw.
This is Walt Richter of Radio Nederland speaking from the Netherlands. More than 1 million people have been struck by disaster, and although the casualty lists already total more than 1,000 dead, complete reports are not expected for days. Nature seems to have turned all her forces and resources against this suffering population. The visitor to Holland will have seen the tranquil beauty of this country's orchards. But today, even an orchard is a weapon of death. In one very graphic picture, in one of the Dutch newspapers, one sees a man helplessly clinging to the last few boards of his upended house, while only 100 yards away, his one means of escape to safety, a rubber life raft, lies helplessly entangled in the branches of one of the trees in his orchard. Help is being rushed south as fast as possible to all of the stricken areas, over land, water, and through the air. But there just aren't enough boats.
This is Ron Krantz of Radio Nederland reporting to News Roundup. We have brought our microphone today to the island of Overflakkee, which was almost entirely inundated during the floods about 8 days ago. 9,000 head of cattle were drowned here. Of course, many people drowned also. But it is the cattle at this moment which constitute the greater part of the work. The dikes have been left until a later date, but the cattle must be removed or else there may be a typhus epidemic.
Of course, there was still confusion with people trying to swallow their grief and clear up the mess.
Here on the border of the flooded areas in Zeeland, everyone is working. The area is running over with military forces, American, French, Belgian, Canadian, and Dutch. Military police are stationed everywhere, directing the hundreds upon hundreds of vehicles, jeeps, light and heavy trucks, amphibious ducks, and cars. Busloads of Dutchmen arrive each morning to work on the dikes until dark. And coming from the other direction are the evacuees, cold, tired, and hungry. The atmosphere here is one similar to warfare, only this time we're fighting the forces of nature instead of mankind. One young girl I spoke to, from a family of 13, had lost everything. I asked what they would do, and she answered with a brave smile, "I guess we shall have to emigrate. There's nothing else."
For the floods came at a time when many Dutch families had already decided to emigrate and start again. The authorities were willing to help.
Most of them are going to Canada. South Africa comes second, then follows Australia and finally New Zealand. Let's take an extreme case. A man with a family who has lost everything. He wants to leave at once. So we find a lodging for him in The Hague, and he is provided by the Red Cross with all he needs in the way of clothing and other necessary articles of equipment. He is given new papers, a passport, and X-ray photos are taken, all free of charge. Then we get him on to the boat.
And there have already been cases of this kind, have there?
Yes, a few. Luckily, not many. But on board the motor ship Fair Sea, which left Amsterdam for Australia on Saturday last, there were no less than 90 emigrants from the flooded areas.
This is Robin Simpson reporting from the island of South Beveland, adjacent to Valkeren, and in an emergency reception hall for refugees in the town of Hoost. I'll give you a brief picture of the scene. There's a circle of typewriters with some very efficient-looking people taking notes and receiving people. They're making documentation of all the refugees who are brought in, and adjacent to them there are a lot of ladies. They've been working, in fact, not only all night but all day yesterday as well, dispensing coffee, cakes. Cigarettes are not forgotten in this aid for mercy, as it were, either. Every now and again, I expect in a few moments you'll be hearing it, there goes the loudspeaker. Frequently, and I'm very happy to say, more often than not, that loudspeaker tells good news to the refugees who are waiting at the other end of this hall.
The official death toll was 1,835 people and tens of thousands of animals. Around 100,000 persons were forced to leave the area. It was 9 months later before the dikes were finally closed, the water pumped out of the polder. Many memories remain.
Everybody knows still how the water came. That's one of the items always the same. Another thing is the powerlessness by seeing their friends, family, neighbours drowning without you was capable to do anything. You saw them on the roofs, you saw it, and then at once they called, help. Then they disappeared under the wreckage, you see. There was not real clean water. It was terrible, dark and dirty water was coming. And cold, of course, very, very cold.
40 years later, the tragic events of 53 are still being discussed. For some people, now of retiring age, this is the first chance they've had to grieve.
After the flood, they were young. They have to do something. They have to build up the houses, to build up the land, something to start a family or start a new family, to do something. But now they are 60, 65 or something, and remembering and thinking and then feeling things coming back. What has happened? Why is my family drowned and why not me? Feeling of guilt is coming. All that kind of things are coming now.
But lessons were learned. Communications was improved. Work began on a 30-year scheme costing just under $7 billion. Jos Geluk of the Delta Works explains that the last section was a special storm surge barrier.
Originally, we had tidal movement, we had salt water, good salt water, and when you close it off, it will become a lake with fresh water, no tidal movement. And against these changes, a lot of people protested. And because of these protests, our government decided in 76 not to close off completely, but to make a storm surge barrier so that in normal conditions, the sea still can go in and out of the eastern Scheldt. And only when it's real necessary, then we have the possibility to lower the gates and then we still have safety against floodings.
That giant construction was officially opened, or rather closed, on October 4th, 1986.
This is
Ginger De Silva
and Neville Gray, and we're broadcasting from the centre portion of the storm surge barrier. Earlier today, Queen Beatrix pulled the lever to lower the floodgates and close the eastern Schelde, thus ending a 30-year project designed to make this southwestern province of Zeeland safe, so that never again can a disaster like that of 1953 occur in the Low Countries.
Hundreds of blue and green balloons were released. There were a whole lot of school children waving flags and cheering.
And in our first broadcast, you could hardly hear us for the brass band that was right behind us.
That's true. And then all of the dignitaries marched back to the Delta Project headquarters to hear the speeches. Among the dignitaries, of course, were the heads of states of all the countries bordering on the three rivers that empty into the North Sea at this estuary. And those rivers are, of course, the Maas, the Rhine, and the Eastern Scheldt, or Skelder. Where we were watching the Queen push the button, we didn't have the best view because we were actually right on top of the storm surge barrier. It felt felt a little bit like standing on the deck of a boat. And the housing of the hydraulic system that raises and lowers the gates actually looks like smokestacks on a steamship liner.
After the Queen started the lowering of the floodgates, she, together with her guests, moved through the crowds of schoolchildren and other onlookers who were here into the Delta Expo building, where she made a speech to mark this historic occasion. And she ended her speech with these words.
During this climax in the history of Holland's hydraulic engineering, we recall the concern for safety, the primary consideration that impelled us to embark on this project. We know that a living nation builds for its future. The completion of the Delta project will certainly make that future safer.
Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands. Thermal expansion of the oceans and melting of the polar ice caps is expected to raise sea levels by 29 centimetres in 40 years' time. Specialists will gather at a conference in Holland in November this year to decide how to tackle this global problem. Another storm surge barrier is being built to protect the new waterway which links Rotterdam to the North Sea, for Holland will never be finished.
Revenge of the Tide was compiled and presented by Jonathan Marks for Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service. The sound balance was by Peter Bos.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.